When hurricanes approach New Orleans, we often have flashbacks to Hurricane Katrina, which devastated the metro area with a catastrophic storm surge flood in 2005. When hurricanes approach the area today, one of the main questions I hear people ask, both inside and outside the metro area, is, are the levees going to hold this time? However, the Big Easy is also susceptible to a different kind of hurricane flooding, inundation from heavy rainfall. In September, Category 2 Hurricane Francine slammed South Louisiana with a track that placed Metro New Orleans to the right of the eye as it tracked inland. The storm generated several bands of very heavy rain that tracked over the metro area, quickly inundating areas in just a few hours. On this episode of the GeoTrek podcast, we travel to Metro New Orleans to learn about the impacts of such massive rainstorms in this region. Hey everyone, I'm Hurricane Hal, host of the GeoTrek podcast. GeoTrek explores the world telling stories about extreme weather and natural disasters not covered by the mainstream media. We focus on the physical processes that generate such extreme events, their impact on society, and what we can do to get out ahead of such events to reduce the loss of life and property. The cost of this podcast is free, but we do ask that you subscribe or follow the GeoTrek podcast on your favorite podcast platform. Your subscription helps us mark progress, making it easier for us to forge professional partnerships and ensuring many more episodes of the GeoTrek podcast in the future. A housekeeping note about this episode, I typically travel to the impact zone of hurricanes before landfall to interact with residents in the disaster zone, document the storm conditions, and stick around to see how I can help out or what insights I can gain. I did not travel to Hurricane Francine, however, because I was already scheduled to give a presentation at the National Waterways Conference in New Orleans the week after the storm. I just couldn't work it out to spend two consecutive weeks in the area, so I just traveled in around 6 to 7 days after the storm and recorded this podcast while I was on the ground for the conference. It still worked out great, however, and I think you'll really enjoy the insights I gained on the ground during this episode of the GeoTrek podcast. Our first guest on this episode is an old friend of the GeoTrek podcast. Chris Franklin, chief meteorologist at WWL-TV in New Orleans, was a star of GeoTrek Podcast 42 and 43, Remembering Hurricane Katrina with Chris Franklin. Chris came back with us on this episode to share insights on Hurricane Francine's rainfall flooding, as well as perspectives on the area's antiquated pumping technology. Visiting Chris in person at the WWL-TV studio in New Orleans French Quarter helped me understand why forecasting the weather in the Big Easy is so hard. It was definitely challenging to arrive at our interview on time, as I had to pass restaurants serving gumbo, sautéed shrimp, beignets, and about 20 flavors of daiquiris. But I kept you, our listeners, at the forefront of my mind and pushed through such temptations to stay focused and bring you this insightful interview with Chris Franklin. Well, I'm here in New Orleans with Chris Franklin, meteorologist at WWL-TV. Thanks so much for coming back on the podcast.
Absolutely, anytime. And how appropriate you're here for a water conference when we're talking about the flooding from Hurricane Francine.
You know, Chris, it's interesting. New Orleans is so complex. You've had a lot of really bad saltwater floods over the years, but then you can also get these big rainfall floods. And there's all these social layers of complexity with New Orleans essentially like a bowl that has to be pumped out and everything. With Francine coming in, it seemed to be more of a rain event and some heavy rain in some areas. I mean, what was that like seeing that coming in? And how easy or difficult was that to communicate with your audience that this is maybe going to be more of a freshwater rain flood threat as opposed to a storm surge threat?
You know, the early stages of Francine, while it was still kind of in the genesis phase in the southwestern Gulf, it looked like this might be more of a wind and storm surge event. It looked like it was going to be, could be a stronger storm. We were thinking more high-end one or two, and to be a fast-moving storm. A lot of folks were comparing this to Ida. Ida took 30 hours to move through South Louisiana. And so with this one, it looked like it was going to be more of a 7-8 hour through the state, should be fast moving. There will be some heavy rainfall setting up, but we don't know exactly where that's going to be. So we're trying to stress more of the all impacts are possible, wind, surge, and rain. We just didn't know what would be the worst. And it ended up being where some areas more isolated had the higher surge. A vast majority of the population, and I'm talking kind of the northern river parishes, so St. Charles, St. John, St. James, our northern bayou parishes, Terrebonne, Lafourche, and Metro New Orleans, which is northern Jefferson, Orleans, Plaquemines, St. Bernard, we had this heavy band, and you saw this burst of convection on satellite as soon as that outer eye wall made landfall, and it kind of exploded over the bayou parishes and then reignited as it started to move slowly over the city. And we had about 2 hours of just a intense 4 to 6 inch, kind of at times 6 to 8 inches of rain accumulate in 2 hours. It doesn't matter how good of your pumping system is. I don't care how great your just normal natural gravity drainage is. That's an area that is going to flood. But as you mentioned, we are a bowl and we have heightened levees to keep normally salt water out. But then the problem is when that fresh water falls into the bowl, you've got to get it out. We did have a few issues with a couple of our pumps that parish and city leaders had mentioned. But with just the vast amount of rain in that period of time, you're going to get flooding.
So, Chris, what were some of the impacts you saw from getting, say, 6 to 8 inches of rain in a short amount of time? I mean, what did that look like on the ground?
On the ground, especially in Jefferson Parish, we have major flood control canals. Those all overflowed. Three of the major canals in Metairie, the largest metropolitan area in Jefferson Parish, we have three major canals. They all three flooded. And as a local, this reminded me very much of the flood of 95, the May 8th, 9th flood. It was a band of rain convection that just sat up and sat for hours. I mean, this lasted much, much longer in the May flood than we saw in Francine, but it reminded me very much of that. It was just the sheer volume of water has nowhere to go fast enough. We can't pump it out fast enough. Drainage can't clear it fast enough. So those would normally help us out with getting the floodwaters out all overtopped, and any homes that were near those canals started to see the inundation.
Chris, when you said the canals overflowed or flooded, so essentially these are drainage canals that are meant to take fresh water. Fresh water is meant to be pumped into these canals and then go out of the city. Is that right? And when you say that they flooded, you mean that like they overflowed? Like basically they were at capacity?
They were at and then beyond capacity. And the way the pumping systems work, for the most part, these canals, they don't actually get pumped. The fresh water that falls into the streets and areas don't get pumped into these. We just have normal drainage that will allow that water to flow. And then if necessary, we have pumps at the ends of the canals that can pump that water either into the lake. Parts of the city or parts of JP have a pump to the river where it just pumps straight back into the Mississippi River. And we also have in parts of Kenner in western Jefferson Parish that pump into the marshes of St. Charles Parish. That pump and one of the pumps that will clear the airport failed. So you've got this massive area of concrete that didn't have its pumping situation working. So the pumps away from the airport had to take up the loss of that pump and had to work overtime. And so we did see some neighborhoods in Kenner that got some of the worst of the metro area flooding.
So some of these areas, say Metairie, Kenner, that saw the big flood impacts, do you think a lot of people were really surprised by what they saw?
I think so, because as I said, you'd have to go back to 95 to the last time we saw that kind of flooding from the canals. Thankfully, though, what was interesting is not long after that rain ended, about 9, 10 o'clock, the rain started to shift more toward the north shore, north of Lake Pontchartrain. And at that point, water was already starting to recede. So as soon as the rain ended in Jefferson and in Orleans, it immediately started to recede. There was maybe a little bit of a time where the streets held the water a little bit. But actually, what's interesting is, and something I never thought of, one of our councilmen for Jefferson Parish said that the streets across much of Metairie are designed. We have curbs on the streets. The streets tend to be lower than the houses. They were actually designed to become flood barriers, to hold the floodwaters. Now, you might get trapped in your home for a night, but the idea being it would normally, you know, over time drain to the canals, then drain out. So the streets are actually designed to hold the water and prevent it from getting in homes. Obviously, that can't be the case everywhere. And so a lot of the homes that you saw as slab homes may have been a little bit closer to the canals or a little bit lower, did see the water come into their houses.
Chris, when we see a hurricane coming towards Houma or Morgan City, do you feel like a lot of people in Metro New Orleans realize, okay, we're on the right side of this, this could be bad for us? Or do you hear still a lot of people saying, oh, the eye is going to miss us, we're going to be okay? Or some mixture of both?
It's probably a little bit of both. And there's always that battle. And we went to the National Hurricane Conference together, and there's always that discussion of that center line. Do you use it in the cone? The spaghetti plots are only forecasting the center of the storm. Even the cone itself is just the center of the storm. So while we do try and, you know, at least get clear that the core of the storm is going to be some of the worst of it, the impacts that can also be devastating are going to be experienced far away and typically on the eastern side. So very much, even as we were looking at this as maybe more of a south central Louisiana, we were talking about it at one time maybe being more over the Atchafalaya Basin, maybe even west of Lafayette or even between Lafayette and Baton Rouge. While maybe the worst would stay away from Metro New Orleans, we were still going to be on the wet side. We were going to get the higher winds. We were at the direction for the higher storm surge and the heaviest rainfall.
Yeah, definitely. Those bands can kind of move in and dump a lot of rain in a really short amount of time. And we've seen how localized that can be, too, that some areas of the metro might be hit and in other areas not as much. Chris, you also mentioned that sometimes these pumps can fail. I mean, is that from losing power? Like, do they usually have backup generation, or is that just a random mechanical thing? Any insight into that?
Sometimes when we're actually doing these at WWL, these massive investigative pieces on our, it's called Down the Drain. If you ever go to our website and look it up, it's a series of investigations we've done. There are some that it's just normal mechanical issues that these pumps and the systems fail. A lot of them have turbines to actually produce their own power. The problem is a lot of the technology, especially in Orleans Parish, is over 100 years old. So we cannot buy replacement parts. They actually have to be built on site. They have to be manufactured to fix some of these 100 plus year old turbines. And some of them are steam turbines. So we're talking, you know, 19th century technology to continue pumping the city of New Orleans in the year 2024. The upgrade would be, you know, millions upon millions of dollars. But it is something that residents here tend to kind of question every hurricane season and every time we get the risk of flooding. I mean, any summertime downpour, springtime floods, we can easily flood. And it almost probably about half a dozen times a year, the question is raised, why can't we upgrade this technology to something that maybe puts us a little bit more into, if nothing else, the 20th century, let alone the 21st century. But yeah, the common issues are these 100-year-old turbines failing. Power goes out. The pumps don't have the electricity to function, and so they are shut down. There were some mechanical issues with others that, you know, they are very difficult. I'm not an engineer, but they are very difficult to maintain. And so I think it's probably, you know, about 50-50 on whether it's not just regular mechanical, you know, technology issues, or it's that they are failing because we can't properly power these systems because the technology is just so old.
Well, that's astonishing. I would have had no idea that you have some of this old infrastructure that's really hard to service, maintain, and keep running. That's amazing. I think a lot of our listeners will be surprised by that. But New Orleans is really old, right? I mean, this is something y'all have been doing for a long time, pumping water out of the city.
I mean, this goes back to the late 1700s when the city was being established. There was always a need to get water out. We are low. Now, it's not all below sea level, but a good portion is. And what areas are above sea level, we're only talking a few feet above sea level. So we're kind of right along the plain of the Gulf of Mexico, and any rise of that water does spell some issues for New Orleans. Now, again, we do have the levee system, and we held pretty well. We weren't truly tested in Ida, but it was certainly a good test. But then, as we saw from Francine, which was a weaker hurricane. Now, I don't like in something Ken Graham with now the National Weather Service in D.C. has always said, don't ever call it a just because those impacts can be devastating, even in a just a tropical storm or hurricane. But what we saw from this one was it ended up being more of a rain event that brought in those issues. Yeah.
Chris, always fascinating to talk to you and to catch up. Any last big pictures of what it's like to navigate these floods and hurricanes and tropical storms? And like you said, you don't even need a name storm. Just any last big pictures to share with our audience about the challenges of living through and forecasting weather here in the Big Easy?
I mean, I think anywhere it's going to be a challenge. I think for the New Orleans market, the meteorologists here, we also have to become hydrologists. As a matter of fact, we were one of our meteorologists and I, Alexa Trishler, were kind of discussing some of the storm surge heights and trying to figure out our very dynamic coastline and trying to figure out exactly how high some of these could be. You know, storm surge numbers are always very difficult to forecast. Some areas did see kind of the worst case scenario. Imagine some of the highest numbers we were forecasting were 10 feet. Few areas briefly saw 11 feet. And then in other areas, we didn't see quite the heights realized. But we have those large inland lakes. They're technically bays, but that water flows in. We have North Shore rivers that will be affected by the storm surge. So that's one, you know, huge aspect. We all have to become hydrologists for a bit during these storms. Wind becomes the other. And then the third being the rainfall. And I mean, you've gone through, I don't know how many hurricanes in your career, figuring out exactly where some of those heavier bands, you know that there is a threat. Where that occurs is near impossible. I mean, where is the convection going to set up? Is it going to just sit? Or if we start getting those feeder bands and then you get the training of rainfall, where does that occur? So all you can really do is talk about kind of the high-end totals that we might see widespread and just make it clear that these could be exceeded and in very isolated locations. If it's out over the Atchafalaya Basin or in some of our marshes, a foot of rain, who cares? But when that foot of rain is over the city of New Orleans, you have some major issues.
Yeah, humans by nature, we want to pinpoint forecast, but like you said, sometimes it's general ideas of what could happen. And a really good point, too, with South Louisiana, what's happening over the saltwater marshes, maybe not a big deal. You move that into the urban corridor, it's a big problem. Chris, really appreciate you taking time to come on the podcast. Hopefully, we won't have any other major tropical impacts here, but you never know. I know you guys, if something does come your way, you'll be keeping your audience abreast and staying on top of it.
We start breathing a little sigh of relief when we get past August 29th. That was Katrina. That was Ida. Isaac. Yeah. So for the 29th, we kind of start breathing that sigh of relief. Once we get to about mid-October is when we can kind of, all right, the rest of the season, even if we get threatened with something, usually isn't a big deal even toward, although almost Halloween a few years ago, we had Zeta. So that rule of thumb has kind of flown out the window. But yeah, we're still pretty active even into early October. So few more weeks to go, then we can start to relax a bit.
Thanks so much, Chris. Appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Anytime, Al.
Thank you so much, Chris, for taking time to share your insights. We had seen TV and social media coverage about Francine's flooding rains in New Orleans, but your perspective about the antiquated pumping technology in the area brings a richer context and perspective to some of the challenges faced in this region. While I was participating at the National Waterways Conference, I struck up an interesting conversation with a local engineer named Andrew Woodruff. He shared insights about some of the unique challenges to managing flood risk in New Orleans. We're here at the National Waterways Conference in New Orleans. I'm here with Andrew Woodruff, a local resident. You have a lot of insights about hurricanes in this area. I mean, tell us what you saw with Hurricane Francine last week and some of the ways people might have gotten blindsided.
Yeah, Hurricane Francine, I think people in New Orleans generally got blindsided. What I see with a lot of hurricanes is people are paying attention to the cone from the National Hurricane Center. They see the eye tracking west of New Orleans, but we really got, you know, the big wet side of the storm in New Orleans. I think the numbers that I saw published immediately following the storm are up to 9 or 10 inches within the city, and that all came within a period of, you know, most of it within 3 or so hours, and just totally inundated the interior drainage system.
Well, and that's an interesting point. A lot of people, when they think about New Orleans and flooding, they're thinking saltwater flooding, storm surge, will the levees hold? But in this case, you're getting tremendous amount of rain in just a few hours. So that's a whole different approach, right?
Yes. I do work in the infrastructure industry. I've been in New Orleans. I've grown up here, lived here my entire life. And yeah, people don't understand the dynamics of that system. We do have the levees on all sides of the cities to prevent us from being inundated with storm surge, but that also keeps all the rainfall within the system. New Orleans is really like a giant bowl, and we have to pump all that rainwater out. So even though we're protected from storm surge, that rainwater just really builds up, and when it comes in such a short period of time, the pumping system just can't keep up, and you know, we're stuck with it. Especially if you have power outages, pumps go down, generator failures, whatever it is, it just starts to compound that problem and make things even worse.
Andrew, I had a question about the pumping system. Is it designed for pumping out so much inches per rain per hour? Is that a uniform rate throughout the city, or does it depend where you are? I mean, how does that work?
So it generally is designed. The rule of thumb that we use is that it can pump an inch of rain within the first hour and then a half inch every hour after that. So if you have rainfall rates that exceed those amounts, then the water does start to stack up. And I think as Maybe many people don't know this, is that when you get those banding effects, you do get really heavy localized flooding, and that water does tend to stack up in certain parts of the city until it can really even itself out.
So when you saw a storm coming in towards Terrebonne Parish or areas west of here, Houma, Morgan City, I'm imagining for you, you're like, this could be bad. But a lot of people were focusing on, oh, the eye is going to miss us. And maybe I'm imagining we're possibly blindsided by what happened.
Yes. And you and I talked a little bit earlier, you know, not only Francine, but just other storms that have struck the area. You know, the dynamics of every storm are different. We've seen it with Isaac, Ida. It just happens over and over again where people pay attention to that center of the storm and are just not taking into account the effects outside of that eye wall and how they can vary so much. You know, what direction is the storm coming from? Where is the water building up? Where is that rain going to start to train? And yeah, I think it definitely caught a lot of people off guard in the city.
Andrew, what can people do if they see a big rainmaker coming in and they're like, okay, we're on the dirty side of the hurricane, a lot of banding, maybe it'll far exceed the pump capacity. I mean, what can people do to maybe move their vehicle or move themselves? I mean, what can they do locally to protect themselves in a situation like that?
Yeah, definitely move their vehicles. And look, when the water starts to rise, I experienced it in my own home. I live very near one of the major drainage pumping stations. When that water does start to rise, it comes fast. We saw in my own street, the water was hip deep within the matter of about an hour. So when you see it start to rise, you do not have time to start to move all of your belongings and get everything out of the way. So you need to have a plan to save your most valuable things quickly. Even in my own family, we've had structures flooded in other parts of the city. And when we have gone back and renovated those buildings, we have even now, whether it's, you know, design your furniture to be able to take on a couple inches of water, or, you know, design your walls a little bit differently so that, you know, your first couple of inches, if you have to rip out baseboard, you're not ripping out, you know, feet of sheetrock. But you should have a plan to get your stuff, whether it's your vehicle, your personal belongings, other, you know, valuables, have a plan to get those out of floodwaters quickly.
Well, what amazing insight. So it sounds like you're saying the water can come in incredibly fast. The time to form a plan is not when that's happening, but it's out ahead of the storm. And it also sounds like you're saying there's things you can do maybe even before a storm even arrives on where you build and how you maybe build your house, for example.
Yes, absolutely. You know, it's all about having the what we call resilient infrastructure in the infrastructure industry, but you can take those same concepts and apply them to your home on a smaller scale, so that you're ready for a storm. And look, storms happen, damage happens, but having the what I'll call infrastructure in place to be able to recover quickly from that.
Andrew, thanks so much for these insights. These are valuable not only for people in New Orleans, but in any flood-prone areas. I've seen a lot of them come in so fast. And like you said, if people don't have a plan, they can be caught off guard. Thanks so much for coming on the podcast, and I wish a good rest of the conference for you.
Yep, awesome. Thanks, Hal. Enjoyed it.
After Andrew and I recorded the first conversation, he shared a story with me of a creative solution his family came up with to mitigate flood losses. The story was too good to pass up, and he agreed to share it on the GeoTrack podcast. I'm still with Andrew at the National Waterways Conference. Andrew, this is amazing. You were talking about building flood-resilient first floors. So obviously, best-case scenario, we never flood. But if we do, it sounds like you're saying there are things that you and your family have done to prepare in case you flood again. What's an example of that?
Yeah, so just a quick example. My dad has a building that flooded in Hurricane Isaac. It did not get a lot of water. It got like 3 to 4 inches of water. But that amount of water was enough to wet the sheetrock. Water starts migrating up, then you're dealing with, you know, cutting out even more sheetrock, potential mold if you're not getting things out quickly enough. So what we did in that situation, which I have to give credit to my dad, it was an excellent idea. Once we cut the sheetrock off, we actually went back with cypress baseboards. I believe they were about 8 to 10 inches, which this was a business, not a home, right? So style may be a concern for you, right? But in that case, if he got 3 to 4 inches again of water in a future storm, we were no longer concerned about water wetting the sheetrock, migrating, creating mold issues, because we had a building material there, right, that is a little bit more resilient that we can go in, you know, hose off when we redid the floors, right? We didn't go back with carpet, went back with some acid wash concrete, which was fine for his business. You know, just thinking ahead of things that if they do get wet in a storm, can we wash them off and go back to life as normal?
So something like concrete instead of hardwood floors, or you're saying like maybe like a cypress baseboards instead of drywall all the way down. Just these adaptations could make a big difference if there was another flood then.
Yes, absolutely.
Andrew, thanks so much. Those are very practical. You know, on the podcast, we like to give people applied ideas of things that they could do where they live. We have a lot of people that listen in flood-prone places, so they're going to take this to heart, whether they live in the Big Easy or far away. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Awesome. Thanks, Al.
Thank you so much, Andrew, for sharing such a specific example of flood mitigation that our listeners in flood-prone areas can use as creative inspiration. The interviews with Chris and Andrew provided professional insights on the unique challenges of mitigating rainfall flooding in a large metro area that is mostly below sea level. I learned so much from both of them, and I'm sure their perspectives will be appreciated by many of our listeners. If you follow the GeoTrek podcast, you know I also love to walk around disaster-prone communities and record interviews with random strangers I meet on the street. This episode was no exception, and you won't be disappointed by the conversation I struck up with Johnny Vindigni at a McDonald's restaurant in Kenner, a city in the western part of New Orleans Metro. I'm here in the western part of Metro New Orleans. Johnny, you were telling me about just how fast the rain came from Francine. I mean, what were some of these things you and some of your friends saw in the metro area?
Well, within an hour, we had almost 4 inches of rain, and I had friends telling me that all of the canals from Causeway all the way down to Kenner were overflowed probably within 2 hours, and they had the streets were flooded, and they had water coming into people's houses that weren't raised.
So this is like water gets pumped into the canals to take it out of the city, but it just came too hard too fast, right?
Too fast, and people were very, very surprised. I mean, instantly there were even reports, people were saying, you know, there's alligators in my front yard and things. I was like, wow, this is crazy. And it was when the storm had hit, it had been maybe an hour.
So it all just came like super fast.
Really, really fast. And the storm, luckily, it was a fast moving storm, and we didn't get a lot of that significant rain poured on us over a long period of time, or we would have been in bad shape.
You were comparing this to Hurricane Ida 3 years ago. That seemed to be more wind, and it maybe moved through faster, right?
The infrastructure here couldn't handle that wind. Ida was a slower-moving storm with a lot faster winds, and it just ripped down trees, knocked down power lines, so everyone was without power for 2 to 3 weeks almost, but there was little to no water damage except for water that was coming in from, if you had, you know, roof damage from the wind tearing off shingles and things like that. So this was complete opposite.
Had you ever seen the area canals overflow like this before?
Not that quickly. And luckily it didn't stay that long. Maybe it stayed 6 hours. In some areas it came up. But, I mean, people that have never flooded got 4 to 5, 6 inches of water up in the garage and into their front rooms and things like that.
Johnny, appreciate you sharing your story. Hopefully this is it for this season, but it sounds like
there's something out there right now. They're saying 40% something forming in the Caribbean. I'm like, oh, no. I thought we got out of it. We're supposed to have a strong season this year. We went all the way until, you know, Francine, and like, oh, now we got another one brewing. So.
Yeah, and, you know, I talked to a few meteorologists that say once you make it through August 29th, yeah, right, that was
good.
Katrina, Isaac, Ida, they all hit on that date.
And then it just turned right around on us.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to keep an eye on it, but I appreciate you sharing your story here.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Wait, this is crazy. I'm still here with Johnny, and you were just sharing, I mean, your history here. You're from here, but even your story post-Katrina is amazing. I mean, tell us why you were here and that story.
Absolutely. I had just gotten back from my first tour in Iraq. I was with 3rd Battalion, 325th, and the 82nd Airborne at Fort Bragg, and I came home, and Katrina hit, and I came home on emergency leave. And I had just left Baghdad a few weeks before and came back to see New Orleans completely destroyed, on fire. There were boats and trees, and I was just in tears because I had been waiting so long to come home and, you know, to have fun. And all of a sudden, it was worse than the war zone.
I was just going to say, you were in a war zone. You come home to, like, your stable life, and it was completely turned upside down.
Completely upside down. And I mean, I had spent the last year, 365 days in Iraq, and I came back, and New Orleans was in worse shape than I had seen in war zones. Yeah.
So what did you do? It sounds like you jumped into action, right?
I came and I could get into Bucktown. My family lived in Lakeview, and I was active duty, so I had my active duty ID. I had my BDUs on, and I went down there and said, just put me to work. So I went there, and I was just trying to help the National Guard guys go out.
So, like, what did they have you doing? What were you doing?
I was going down and helping clear buildings. They're like, look, you know, combat arms, you just gotten back from overseas. You could come over here. I didn't arm myself. I went in kind of like because I wasn't supposed to actually be doing anything. I was still technically on emergency leave, but I checked all my family, my home and everything. Luckily, everyone evacuated to Hammond and then up to Baton Rouge. So I went in and I was just kicking doors and trying to help people. And
so you're kind of like going around, and a big part of was going through the metro area and checking for.
And I knew the area. A lot of the guys, National Guard, were coming in weren't quite as familiar with the area as I was. So I was trying to help coordinate, you know, getting people around and then figuring out where the worst parts of the city that were hit and stuff like that. So I did that for about 3 days.
Because there were some buildings with deceased, but then other places there was security and looting issues. There was a lot going on, right?
I was helping, like, cordon off certain areas, because that's literally what I just done in Baghdad, was help doing search and rescue and, you know, going in and finding, you know, cordoning off certain areas of the city. And I was like, well, I was just doing all this stuff, you know, with the 82nd. I'd come in and help National Guard guys out.
Wait, so you were working alongside the National Guard with them. Man, what a crazy situation.
I inserted myself in and then just kind of scooted out a couple days later once they kind of got everything under control.
Did it feel like part of you was still in Iraq, but then you're back home to it?
A few times I was snapping back and forth, and because there was no power, and that's, they had blackouts, you know, citywide in Baghdad, and then there was no power here, and there's still fires, and there's looting, and there's just then the eerie quiet because there's no electricity. I'm like, man, I can't believe that this is home, you know, that I'm back home now.
Johnny, appreciate you sharing your story. Thank you for your service. And again, I'm hoping this is it for this hurricane season. But it sounds like if more comes this way, you're prepared.
I'm ready to rock and roll. I'm not going anywhere. So,
thanks, Johnny. Appreciate you coming on the podcast.
All right, thank you.
Well, Johnny, I don't even know what to say. My mind is blown just hearing the story you just shared with us. I mean, for our listeners, could you imagine serving in combat in a war zone and then coming back home to the USA, and you find your hometown has been destroyed as badly or worse than in the conflict zone you left behind? And then imagine jumping in to provide leadership and experience clearing buildings in a disaster zone, even though you don't really have formal authority to do that. Hats off to you, Johnny. What a testimony of quick thinking and bravery to help our citizens out in a rapidly deteriorating situation. Just a very inspirational story. And y'all, these are the types of stories you'll only find on the GeoTrek podcast. We love to get on the ground and find these untold gems, these stories in disaster-prone communities that are inspirational and things that we just don't hear about in the mainstream media. Big thanks to Chris, Andrew, and Johnny for their unique insights on this episode of the podcast. I learned a lot in the Big Easy, and my perspective changed too. I understand now that the area is not only vulnerable to storm surge, but really to these heavy rain events as well. Not only meteorologically, but some of the issues with the old pumping stations and that old technology. Like Chris Franklin said, some of it is 19th century technology that can get expired and that can be difficult to keep up to date. Well, hey, that's a wrap from Metro New Orleans. Stay safe during this ongoing hurricane season, everybody, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the GeoTrek Podcast.